On this episode of Skeptico,
we've established as well as we can the physical phenomenon. Tell us about the spiritual phenomenon as it once started and then as it progressed. You have some very provocative, controversial information that you've brought back, and also some information that you think is important scientifically, if we will, about what's going on with consciousness. So, gee, where do you want to begin?
If you said, why have you been having them? I'd say it's about our evolution. It's about learning. And every now and then, we get these odd cases like mine thrown in, and it gives science, it gives the medical profession, it gives us all an ability to look deeper into something that interests us and that might have answers. And spiritually, one of the things that, you know, I often hear, you know, people don't believe that an NDE is a real event, and they say, well, it's caused by false memories or illusions. I can say without any hesitation that is absolutely not the case.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's show, very interesting, challenging account from someone who's had just an unbelievable number of near-death or real-death experiences. Beverly Gilmore, as you'll hear in this show, has experienced 30 years of more or less continuous, off and on, near-death experiences. What she's gained out of that, the message that she has, is, I think, quite controversial, or at least it will be for some people. There's definitely a strong Jesus angle to her experience. But she also has an insight in terms of consciousness that is quite unique and quite interesting as well, and could have implications for near-death experience research and consciousness research in general. I was extremely skeptical going into this interview, and I have to say I'm less skeptical coming out. I don't know what to make of everything that Beverly has to say, and you'll hear that in this interview as well, but I'm not too quick to dismiss what she says either. I hope you enjoy my interview with Beverly Gilmore. Today we welcome Beverly Gilmore to Skeptico. Beverly is the author of A Journey of Actual Death Experiences, Who I Am, The New Divine Teachings of Jesus, a book in which she explores human consciousness and her understanding of it from amazingly 30 years of more or less continuous near-death and after-death experiences. It's really quite an amazing account, and I've just expressed to Beverly, I have all sorts of skepticism, but at the same time am anticipating some of the really remarkable things she's discovered in this medical and spiritual journey she's been on. So Beverly, it's awesome to have you on Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
It's great being here. Thank you for having me here.
Well, so as we were just talking about, you've been at this for a while. That's not even the right way to say it. You really have to kind of start, I think, with your story, because it's a unique medical story in terms of your experiences with what we've come to know as near-death experiences. But as they kind of manifest in you, it's kind of even more of a medical mystery. Can you start just by kind of telling your story?
Well, they actually began in 1987. And to say that it's been my life is an understatement. You know, it's been 30 years. And when they first started, you know, and for many years after, I had no idea what was happening to me. And I reached out and gradually.
So let me interject right there, because even that, we have to say what it is that happened to you, how it physically felt. And then that first point is really important, that when it first happened, you just were completely unaware of what's going on. So what was it like the first couple times this happened? What physically did you feel?
I physically felt the very first times it happened is just my head came out of my body. That was all. And so I didn't sort of like, I didn't even know what a near-death experience was anyway. But I didn't really understand. I just thought I was dreaming. And then a few nights later, I was able to sit up. And I noticed that my legs were stuck. I couldn't move my legs. I could turn myself around, but I couldn't move my legs.
So this is at nighttime. You're going to bed.
Only at nighttime. It never happens. It happens when I actually go to bed. If I go to bed during the day, it could happen. But it only happens when I'm in that state of complete rest.
So just let me probe that tiny bit further. Is it deep in kind of a REM cycle? Is it early on in the kind of hypnagogic state when we're first falling asleep? When does it occur? A lot of people have associated that with, you know, astral projection, out-of-body experiences. Is it that? Is it something different? Medically, you've kind of looked into it. What's going on there?
Well, what actually goes on, it happens straight away as soon as I actually, you know, when I'm going to have one, I'll be lying down and I can sense this is happening because it's sort of like I go into a very, very deep sleep. But then I pass that stage and it's like I suddenly become aware of everything. And I'm telling my body to move. I'm instructing it to actually move. And I can see what's going on around in the room. But I know my eyes are shut. And then I actually feel myself rising upwards. And that's when I'm actually coming out of my body. And what it turns out is from the... Now that I'm being treated by my doctors, is that first of all, what happens is I go unconscious. So this is something to do with the brain. I actually go unconscious, and then that affects my heartbeat, and then my heartbeat slows down until it becomes nil. And then as that happens, it affects the breathing, and then the next thing that happens is my brain starts shutting down. So it's all, you know, it's all connected. It's like a cycle. And it all happens spontaneous from each other. And then I actually leave my body, and that's basically the passing over. So I have no connection to the physical body at all, but I can't see myself lying there.
So Beverly, one more medical question there. You said your heartbeat goes to nil. Is this something your doctors have verified, or even, you know, someone around you has verified that your heartbeat is very faint, or, you know, medically they'd have to kind of hook you up to an EKG or something and say you have no heartbeat? What are you saying medically when you say that?
It stops because, I mean, it just stops. It stops beating.
And how do you know that?
Well, I can feel it, but apart from that, the people around me who have actually witnessed it, they actually see me go into this state where I'm non-responsive at all. And also in 1989, Oliver, they actually stopped when I got pregnant, okay, which was, it's something that I'd like to look into more. And then on the 8th month of the pregnancy, I had one, and I got really upset because I didn't know, you know, had it damaged my baby, you know. And I ended up in hospital, and I flatlined on the machines. And the gynecologist and the doctors that came from, they actually induced Oliver 8 weeks early in case I had another one. So that was the first time I came to the medical attention, was 1989.
So, Beverly, at that time when you were in the hospital and they say you flatlined, were you outside of your body at that time witnessing it?
Yeah, I was. And I luckily was hooked up to monitors because they were monitoring the baby. So I was hooked up to heartbeat monitors and everything.
What did you think as you were observing that outside? And then also a related question, did that feel similar to these other experiences where you can say, I was flatlined there, so I probably was flatlined other times, or did it feel somewhat different than at other times?
No, it was exactly the same. The awareness was the same. It was exactly the same. It's not been any different from the beginning. It was just the only difference in the very beginning was those first three times when I didn't come out of my body completely. And then about the fourth time, I actually came straight out. And since then, I was always just straight out. You know, as soon as the heartbeat stopped, as soon as the brain started shutting down, breathing stopped, came straight out.
And how long will these periods go when you are medically, clinically dead? How long in our time will that last?
Well, there's no set rule to the time period. It's a case of, you know, it's been a few minutes, you know, just things like that. It's never been for hours, but it's been a few minutes. But people often say, because when I come back, I start jumping, you know, as if I'm being brought back. And I start, the body starts to jerk upwards. And you can see me jumping as if I'm being given an electric shock. Because what actually happens to me, Alex, and this is fascinating for science, is when I'm aware of returning back into my body, I actually focus on the back of my brain stem at the back. And it's like you literally are plugging something in. And you know when you plug something in, you get a burst of energy? It's like I get plugged back in and this ball of energy, it's bright and it just explodes. And it just travels down my back into through my spine and it hits my heart. And it literally, you know, and that's what actually brings me back. It's actually... bringing my heart back to the rhythm. It's and normally only takes one time, but sometimes it's been two or three times when I've had to, you know, feel that, and then I've come back, and then I gasp for breath and I start, you know. But the length of time is, the longer it takes me to recover, I would say I've gone longer then, because obviously I can't just sit up after an experience. You know, I'm sort of like, you know, trying to absorb everything and trying to reconnect with my body.
I imagine it's physically draining as well. Hey, as long as we have Oliver there, who is your son, as you just mentioned, Oliver, have you ever witnessed directly Beverly doing this kind of reentry, resuscitation, self-resuscitation when she's been in this condition?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've witnessed it many times, and sometimes you have to restrain, because the force is so powerful. You know, she could easily hurt herself. She could fall out of bed, and she could hit her head. So sometimes, you know, you have to sit by her and make sure that when she is coming back, she isn't going to harm herself physically, you know.
So you've seen your mom, and your mom is essentially dead, appears to be dead, no breathing, no anything. If you were to reach down and take her pulse, I don't know if you've ever done that. Maybe you can tell us. She doesn't appear to have any pulse, and this goes on for how long, and then what is that self-resuscitation process like?
Well, I don't actually intervene with the process at all. I've got to say that it probably started when I was very young. You know, I first became aware of it probably when I was around 11 years old. And many times I just thought she was asleep. And as a child of that age, I didn't really, you know, understand death or what to do if you do discover someone deaf. And I imagine that's the same case with many young children. You know, it's one of those things. And it was only as I got older, I picked up on, you know, how cold she was, you know, how unresponsive she was. But, you know, it always seemed to occur that when I would be around her, if I would hear movement, I would go and check in on her. And then the jerking would start suddenly soon after. I can't say that I was there when she, you know, put her to bed and said goodnight, and then she would go through the physical death. And then if I heard something later on, half an hour later, go in and check her. And then within a couple of seconds, the jerking would start. And then I would know that something's wrong. So I would be there to supervise that she didn't hurt herself. But in terms of applying like CPR or mouth to mouth.
No, I mean, great. I appreciate that. It's just, now we have someone else who was, even though you're a family member, you're just telling it like you experienced it, and it corroborates Beverly's account. And then just one other kind of minor detail on this. So the time period, Beverly, your best guess in terms of how long these after or actual death experiences, as you call them, how long those last, what's your best guess? And you said there's a range. What is the range?
I would say the best guess, a couple of minutes, because, you know, I don't know, to be honest, Alex. I really, really don't know. I feel like it's only a couple of minutes because there doesn't seem to be any time concept when you pass over. So 1 minute it's happening, next minute I have the experience and I see what I see and do what I do. And the next thing, you know, because the consciousness is, well, the physical death itself is quite, you know, it's the natural physical death. It's not painful. It's quite pleasant. It's just a transfer of consciousness. And then the coming back. So it all just happens. So am I actually out longer? Well, you know, I don't really know, to be honest with you, to be fair. But other people have also witnessed it. You know, when friends have stayed over and things like that. Like I've had a friend stay over and we top-to-toed, you know, in bed because a sleepover. And she's gone down the next day. She's gone to get Oliver. She's gone down and said, you know, your mum had one of those experiences last night and she was quite frightened by it. So it's not just the family members who have witnessed this. There's also lots of other people over the years. So it's been quite... It's quite traumatic for other people to actually witness this, to be honest with you.
Right. And I understand from your account that it's quite traumatic for you, even both the physical part of it, and you feel very drained and physically not well after it. But then also, as we'll talk about, the spiritual process of what you've gone through. So I don't know. It does seem to be quite a toll on you, right?
Well, it is, because there's the physical aspects of it as well is from 1992, I had the most horrendous, absolute horrendous burning pain in my head constantly. And we're talking to the point of you could not come near my head, you couldn't touch it. And I was like, I was just almost like a vegetable, to be quite honest with you. I'd just sit there and I could not move. And if anyone tried to put their hand near my head, it would just burn more. And it used to, it would burn. And, you know, when my emotions changed, if I was happy, it would burn in one place. If I was sad, it would burn in another place. Then it would shift over and flow down the back. And my previous doctor, Dr. Curzon, I once went and I had this attack of the burning, and he sat me down and he realised he couldn't approach my head. And I'm partially deaf, so I don't have natural hearing. But someone came into the room, and even though I couldn't turn myself to see that person, I was able to pick up on that person's movement around that room, every step of the way she moved and what she did. And I was telling Dr. Curzon, and he was, you know, sort of observing this, and he was quite taken back by it. So that burning aspect that I have, that's related. And I think what that was doing was helping, was part of the physical aspect of constantly having these ADEs. So it's quite, well, utterly horrendous. I still have it now and then, but not as I used to have it.
Okay. So we've established as well as we can the physical phenomenon. Tell us about the spiritual phenomenon as it once started and then as it progressed. You have some very provocative, controversial information that you've brought back, and also some information that you think is important scientifically, if we will, about what's going on with consciousness. So, gee, where do you want to begin?
I don't know. I mean, I would say it's all about, if you said, why have you been having them? I'd say it's about our evolution. It's about learning. And every now and then, you know, we get these odd cases like mine thrown in, and it gives science, it gives the medical profession, it gives us all an ability to look deeper into something that interests us and that might have answers. Spiritually, one of the things that, you know, I often hear, you know, if you don't believe that an NDE is a real event, and they say, well, it's caused by false memories or illusions, I can say without any hesitation that is absolutely not the case. Because it's just, you know, the things that I saw, the things that I was being taught, some of them I didn't like, Alex. I'll be honest with you, I really didn't like them. And I certainly wouldn't have been able to associate them with my life as it was before they started. You know, I had, in the beginning, I mean, as you know from the book, I always meet with Jesus, but in the beginning, you know, I was more excited and more concerned the fact I'd met with my late father, who passed over. And then even that experience where all he said to me was, learn to do as you are told, Beverly. And then I came back. And I can remember afterwards feeling quite disappointed, like, is that it? Is, you know, I love you, I miss you, you know, I've met you now in the afterlife, I know you're alive, I know you're there, and is that all you're going to say to me? You know, I want you to tell me how much you love me and miss me and things like that. And, you know, so whatever I wanted, I didn't get in that respect, if you can understand where I'm coming from here. Do you know what I mean? You know, like, there was, in the beginning, I tried to control them because, you know, that's my personality. And I thought, well, if I can control them, I can, so, you know, because one time I thought I was becoming a psychic, you know, a medium. And I remember lying down on the bed and I remember saying, like, okay, I'm going to have one now. No, I didn't have one. And then if I was, you know, I feel extremely tired, because I always noticed that before I had one, I would get extremely tired, as if the energy is draining from me. And I'd say, no, I don't want one. I know, and I'd beg and plead, please, no. And I'd have one. So as far as my control is concerned, it was zero. There was nothing there. So
Beverly, you just kind of quickly mentioned a point that I think is going to be a stumbling block for a lot of people. For other people, it's going to be the greatest point of your whole thing, and that's this encounter with Jesus, as you understand that. Talk about that. When did it begin? How did you come to know that was Jesus? Who do you understand Jesus to be? The other really controversial things is you talk about the new divine teachings of Jesus, prophecies that you've brought back from Jesus, predictions that you say have come true during this period that you've had this. All that's going to be very interesting to people.
Well, he was there from the beginning. You know, when I was telling you about how in the beginning I was just coming out partially, I did notice that there was a figure in the corner, and the figure was dressed like a monk. Couldn't see his face or anything, just this shadowy figure. And that actually scared me, because, you know, that was my bedroom, and I didn't know that was in the spirit, that I was actually seeing that. But when I first realised it was him, has to be the one where I actually asked him. I said, are you my Lord Jesus? And he replied, why do you ask, child, do you not know? And then I felt this horrendous, not shame, but it was like silliness for even asking him, because I could feel it was him. I could see it was him. I could see his face, you know, and his disciples were there. And even though I could, when you know that you feel love as well, there was this amazing feeling around him. It was a mixture of love, but it was also this like authority that came from him. And
you do mention in the book that you were frightened during these periods too. It wasn't all love and light with Jesus. You were also afraid of him, right?
Well, I, I was afraid of what was happening to me, Alex, because when I realised I couldn't control them, I kept thinking. I wasn't thinking because I didn't understand the concept of near-death experiences. I'd never heard of it before, or actual death experience, or astral travelling, or out-of-body experiences. So what was going through my you know, very young, naive mind at the time was, I'm cheating death. You know, it's my time. And obviously, I didn't want to die, you know. I wanted to live. I wanted to be a wife. I wanted to be a mother because I had a young daughter. I had a home. And so I was very, very scared because I couldn't understand why it kept happening. And I kept thinking, I just said, you know, I'm dying. That's it. I'm going to die young and you know, my child's going to grow up without her mother.
And there weren't any immediate answers to these questions, right?
No, absolutely not. None at all whatsoever. And it was just like, I was just fumbling along. And what I ended up doing, I suppose, is I ended up starting to understand that you've got to have faith. You've got to have courage. And you've got to have a little bit of strength to believe in your convictions. And the one thing that I did understand about Jesus, because I'm not actually a religious person, the one thing I understood about his story, shall we say, is that he's not a bad person. You know, he's not. He comes with love. He comes with salvation. He comes with all these nice things. So I had to learn to try and trust him and try and physically and mentally and emotionally put that in a compartment saying, well, okay, you're there, I'm meeting you, and I'm coming back. Okay, I don't know why, don't understand it, but I'm still living, I'm still breathing, so, you know. And that's what I tried to do all the time, but I did live out, I started becoming very successful in my career, and I was a very joyful person. But behind the smile, there was that nagging feeling of sadness that no one understood, you know. So, if you know what I mean, I was hiding behind a mask a lot.
In your career as a writer of children's books?
Yeah, because what I noticed I was doing is I noticed that I would see something, you know, like I would see these buildings made of precious stones. It was amazing. I mean, it's obviously going to be amazing. If you saw a building made of precious stones, you'd gasp because it's of the beauty. And what I found I was actually doing is when I was then creating my children's books, I was actually allowing the NDEs to influence the characters. Like, for instance, one of my characters became Lord Nymus. He's the spirit council. And basically that was Jesus, can you see what I was doing?
Sure.
The characters, the Snow Mites, were all named after precious gems, and they adopted the colour. And then I was describing this place called Heavenina. So I was actually doing that for a long, long time. I was just going to say, but these ADZEs were not about just writing a children's story. They're a lot more complex and far more important to us than that. Go on.
No, very good point taken. So, you know, from communicating with me in the past and from kind of being aware of the Skeptico show, I've really explored this topic of extended consciousness and, in particular, near-death experience. I've explored a lot because I think it's tremendously important, particularly given the cultural bias we still have, or the scientific oriented cultural bias we have against this, you know. So if you go out, any poll you do, 90% of people will believe that there's more, that there's something like God, or however you want to put it. But when we turn to science and the intellectual academia kind of thing, there's this real rejection of it. So I'm very open to this. I'm open to the idea of Christ consciousness, because it pops up again and again and again. And when I say Christ consciousness, I'm making a distinction between our historical accounts of this figure called Jesus and what people are experiencing in these extended consciousness realms, if you will, either through after-death experiences, near-death experiences, after-death communication experiences, like with mediums or whatever. People talk to Jesus, see Jesus, even through psychedelics, people see Jesus, talk to Jesus. So I'm not closed to all that. But at the same time, in trying to get a handle on it the best I can, as someone who has not had a near-death experience, I'm drawn to the data, the evidence. You know, I sent you the video with Dr. Jeff Long, who's probably explored this more than anyone else. And what you find is you get a lot of people who say they've experienced Jesus or something like Jesus, or like you said, someone who they felt was this kind of supreme being. They weren't sure it was Jesus. But then you get a lot of other people who say something different, or that they say that the religions are just kind of a metaphor for all this supreme goodness and light that leads up to this hierarchical thing. So one of my interest areas in talking to you, Beverly, is to try and sort out this Jesus thing, because I think it's tricky. There's a lot of evidence for it, but like I say, if you go look at the body of the evidence, like Dr. Jeff Long did in his latest book, it really points more towards this consciousness that extends beyond one particular religion. Do you have any insight into, you know, like that was a long speech on my part, but it leads up to a quote that in your book, you say, Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, that kind of shuts the door to a lot of other things, if you will.
Well, it kind of like, it does sound like it's, I'm saying, you know, it's all good. It's religious, a religious book, but it's not. I mean, as I encountered him, as the information that was coming to me, it was coming to me that he was, because, for instance, the first time I wasn't able to speak, I wasn't able to say anything. And these disciples who were there, who claimed to be his disciples, made me show Jesus this respect, made me bow my head. And that's how it would come across. And it was also come across that when he was present, Alex, and this is really important, that evil spirit, which the word evil is a bit, you know, OTT, but bad spirit or what you want to call it, you know, destructful spirit, could not, it was afraid of this man. It was afraid of him. And it would literally, like, you know, cower away. Now, I never sensed any kind of religion around him. I never sensed any religion in the afterlife. But I did sense that he was the Son of God, and I did sense that he was the teacher. And I also sensed that it basically he comes and his part in all this was to educate us on what we had actually taught ourselves. If that's a better word of putting it, there wasn't a sort of condemnation or condemning or judgment. That wasn't what came across. It was more of a sense of, right, like, for instance, he would ask me a question and I would reply the question as I thought was the truth. Like, you know, why did you do something? And I answered that. And obviously what we think we do things with, the reason we think we do things and the reason we are actually doing them don't always tally with each other. And so until I actually realized that I wasn't answering truthfully, I kept having to go back and answer that question and dig a little deeper into, you know, and what the truth of that answer was from me, you know, as in who I was as a person. And that's why they're called the Who Am I, because you actually ask yourself, who am I? You know, what person am I? What kind of person am I? What do I know? What do I believe in? What do I say? What do I do? So, you know, it's like I mean, I could say to you, for starters, when I grew up, what influenced me about Jesus was, I don't know if you remember it, but it was the film called The Jesus of Nazareth, and it came out at Easter. Do you ever remember that?
I don't remember that particular one, but go ahead.
I would have been about 12 years old. And that was how I learned about him. And I learned about him when I was younger, but it was all very childish. It wasn't through church. It wasn't through Sunday school, because I didn't go to church. I didn't go to Sunday school. I didn't have religious parents. But, you know, he didn't sit me down in the spiritual essence and say, well, you have to go to church. You have to do that too. You have to find me through this avenue or that avenue. What he did do is, you can find me through speaking the truth. And the truth was this main underpinning, educating lesson of everything, you know. Speak the truth, you know. Doesn't matter. And if you don't like what truth that you are, change yourself. Become a better person, you know. And to me, that's invaluable, because at first I didn't want to listen.
Sure. So
I got told off a lot.
No, I get that. So here, I'm going to persist a little bit further with this, because it's just of great interest to me. So the Who Am I teaching is awesome. It's somewhat universal. It's through a lot of wisdom traditions, as is the teaching of truth, of seeking the truth, of being the truth, all that. Also kind of universal. Both those fit in with the research I'm going to continually point to again and again in this show of Dr. Jeff Long, because he's the first near-death experience researcher who was brave enough to kind of look past the basic evidence that suggests, as you pointed out, that these experiences are real, they're a medical mystery, and the only conclusion we can draw from them medically, scientifically, is that consciousness somehow, in some way we don't understand, extends beyond bodily death. That's the conclusion of every near-death experiencer I know of who's actually studied the phenomenon. So there's one, that's the physical part. What I like about Dr. Long is then he's gone one step further and said, okay, now that we've established that, it's fair to start looking at the content and start understanding these experiences in the aggregate, in the whole, in terms of what people are getting. And what they're finding, what his finding doesn't support the idea, you know, Jesus is the Son of God. There's one path. It's Jesus. This is it. That doesn't really come through. When you look at all the experiences, some people experience that if that's what they're meant to experience, if that's how the teaching needs to come through to them, that's what they experience. But people of other religious traditions or spiritual traditions get kind of the same message. They just get it in a different way. And that last part, let me add in, because I want to be kind of precise. That was kind of my interpretation of it, but it's been the interpretation of many people, is that it seems like in these extended consciousness realms, it's kind of an as below, so above kind of thing. So the way we learn things, the way we understand them inside of a cultural narrative that we're already familiar with is how they're delivered to us in this extended realm as well. So the question then through all that is, do you think that this experience and this Jesus thing is exclusive? You think everyone's going through that path, or eventually will go through that path? Or do you think it is this kind of plurality of different spiritual paths that many near-death experienced people might be experiencing in different ways? I'm not looking to lead you in that. I'd just like your best guess based on what you've experienced.
Well, I can only answer it that way, obviously. From what I saw, from what I learned, it's something that everyone will eventually go through. I mean, I saw my own father, who passed away in 82, and he was an alcoholic when he was alive, and he didn't believe in Jesus, but I saw him in the presence of Jesus. So, you know, that's kind of like he was there, I was there, and he acknowledged the presence of Jesus. And that was quite surprising because, as I said, I'd never even heard him speak the name Jesus when I was growing up. So I think I'm trying to answer that. You know, for me to see my father in the presence and was going through some kind of who am I learning from him, because that very first one I was talking to you about, you know, the one where he said, learn to do as you are told, Beverly, and that was it. Later, I actually only met my dad three times in the whole 30 years, which, you know, I wish I'd have met him a lot more, but obviously it wasn't to be. But in a later one, he actually told me that what he was doing that first time round was he was learning that his parental skills towards me when he was alive wasn't in my best interest, and that he should have been a more disciplined parent rather than this trying to be, you know, best friends kind of thing, because my dad never gave me discipline, you see. So I could understand why he said, learn to do as you're told. But the answer didn't come until several years later. But at least I understood then. That's why he said it. Do you see where I'm coming from?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, for him to meet Jesus, for him to be there in the presence when Jesus was there, he's gone through it. You know, he's having this one-to-one journey with him. So... And the same goes when I met my my nanny passed over, and actually my late husband when he passed over. And that again is another interesting part, because it was quite a messy divorce, and we hadn't spoken to each other in 15 years. It was really bad, Alex. And yet I had this ADE in which I saw, you know, my ex-husband, and he actually stepped forward, and he was standing with Jesus, and he actually said to me, you know, become healthier. And at the time I was terrible. I used to still smoke, which I was shown not to, and he told me to stop smoking. Now, when I came out of that, I actually was in so many tears. I was so emotional, because here we are as two intelligent people not speaking to each other when we had this life, and here he was, now he's passed over, and all he had to say to me was words of love, you know, I mean, because that was, it was a loving message. He wanted the best for me. He wanted me to improve my life, and, you know, I'll forever be grateful to him for that. And we're now friends. We are actually now friends. So it just goes to show you. You know, and I never heard my ex-husband speak about Jesus when he was alive either.
Okay, so
is it stopping you? I hope it is.
No, it's all very good. So let's. I mean, people are going to be intrigued from the title about his—that is, Jesus's spiritual prophecies and the new divine teachings that you have brought back. So. Lay it on them. What are the prophecies? What are the new divine teachings?
From 1987 to 1992, I never actually wrote anything down about the NDEs, the ADEs. You know, I never wrote down what I was experiencing. Yes, it influenced my children's writing, but I never wrote anything down. And then in the September of the August of 1992, my ADE suddenly changed, and I was having them quite regular. I mean, I'm talking about they were happening over and over, and they were happening like once every 2 weeks, once every two times a week, and I just had no life at all. I was just so drained. And what started happening is when I was coming back, instead of, you know, just going straight into consciousness, I was entering into this like a trance state of consciousness where I wasn't completely back, but I was. Do you understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'd start writing. And these letters, that I was writing, oh, Alex, I mean, some of them were like 30, 40 pages long, and I didn't stop. You know, I didn't know why I was writing them, what I was actually writing, but I can remember that it was like I would ask a question. This is, you know, Beverly the woman was asking a question, and then this the spiritual entity, this higher consciousness, was answering that question on such a level that it was absolutely astronomical. And that level it was answering them was what Jesus had been speaking about in the ADEs. Like, the reason why I was taken on to this journey, there was one ADE in which he carried my spirit, and we ended up, and it was like this, the most incredible area of space, so to speak. You know, there was the stars and everything. It was like the galaxies were there. And below me, I could see the planet Earth. And I knew it was the planet Earth. And the next minute, he held me. Next minute, we just went at this incredible speed and went around the global Earth and back up into space. And then I was held there. And then I turned slowly round. And then eventually I was pulled back and came back into my body. Now, he actually refers to this one as, you know, when I was telling you it took me time to understand and trust, and he refers to this one, why do you still not trust? He says, I have carried your spirit around the earth in its global form and returned your spirit safely back into your body. Why do you still not trust? The thing is, Alex, is I didn't know I didn't still trust him. You know, I thought I did. And he was saying, no, your truth is that you don't. And he was right. Because if I did really trust him 100%, I wouldn't have been lying there at night time saying, oh, please, no, 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 I don't want another one. You know, I would have embraced him more. I would have said, yes, you know, teach me everything. But I was always reserved. So he was correct. You know, there was that element where I still didn't trust him completely. And I'm sorry if that, you know, upsets people, but yeah, I loved him very much, and I just didn't know that was in me, you know, that, you know, sort of like arm's length.
So what are some of the prophecies? You've said that some of the prophecies that Jesus gave you have actually come true. What are some of those?
They have, because they were talking about, it was like, well, there was particularly one man, and he was showing me that this man would go to jail. And the reason for that is because this man was taking a dark path in life. And he showed me what happened to this man's spirit. And so I wrote it down, and I actually tried to warn this man, and I didn't know what I was warning him against. So I said, you know, if you carry on doing what you're doing, you're going to go to prison. And sure enough, he went to prison. And I was also, one of the things about these spiritual prophecies is that my ADEs change slightly. And this is the surprise I'm going to bring on to you, because this is something that I've never read before. Okay? Now, one of the things he used to do to me in some of the ADEs is when I didn't go through the light, and I'd literally be like earthbound, I'd be exploring the earth here. And what he actually did with me is, it was sort of like he put me into stand observing the life of others in their physical life as they were speaking and doing things. Obviously, they couldn't see me, they couldn't see him, but I was able to hear them and see them. And then when I came back, I wrote down what I actually saw and what I actually heard. And on two occasions, and this is quite astonishing, on two occasions, two people actually say they saw me on two occasions. Now, when I met with people and I said, there was even a man, even as I think it was 2014, 2013, he sensed that I was there, and I saw what I was supposed to see. And I don't go to them. I wait for them to come to me. And he says, were you there? And I said, yeah. And then I tell them what I saw, and they confirm it then. And that's random people, Alex. So, you know, not people who are just friends who are going to confirm it because they don't want to hurt my feelings, you know. So how can an NDE be illusions or false memories if you can actually say what people are doing in their physical lives and it's correct? It's impossible for it to be, you know, illusions or false memories. So that's the kind of thing.
So, Beverly, one of the things that you mentioned, and Oliver mentioned this to me in the email exchange, so I'm going to bring it up. You believe that you have a new and important understanding about the relationship between consciousness in the physical realm, physical plane, and consciousness in this extended plane, spiritual plane. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, what it basically is, Alex, and it's fascinating, and it's something that will help us evolve, because what he taught me was that every one of us, we're all together, we're all linked together, we all have this consciousness. And the physical mind, this earthly consciousness, we are a teacher. And the thoughts that we have are teaching our spiritual essence, are teaching our higher consciousness. And that in turn develops the emotions. Now, okay, it might be a bit difficult to explain this over the radio, but for instance, you are having a logic conversation with yourself all the time, even though you might not realize it. But if you actually sit back and think, okay, what are my thoughts? What are the general thoughts? Say, for instance, you wanted to watch the television. This is just a small example, okay? I want to watch TV. I wonder what's on. And then you pick up a remote, you turn it on. Oh, I'm in the mood for comedy. You flip through it, comedy comes on. Now, if you just out of curiosity, Alex, write down what you think your thought process would be during that experiment, and you'll actually see that it doesn't make logic sense because it's all sort of like direction thought. But what's actually happening to you is your higher consciousness is asking you, why? Why do I want to watch TV? What am I in the mood for? And that's a part that you don't hear. And that's giving you an actual logic conversation 24/7 all the time. And when we look at this, when we look at NDEs, instead of just looking at as beautiful as they are, instead of just looking at the beauty, we need to look at the psychological side of it. We need to look at each experiencer, how they began, and go right through it and see how it changed them, and see the psychological aspect of what changed there. And I think we'll get much more answers because, you know, it, when you understand that you are your own teacher and all your thoughts are teaching you this, you know, spiritual entity, then it kind of like knocks things like addiction in the head, because you can actually turn around and say, you know, I do not want another drink. It's not good for me. And you can sever the emotional aspect of wanting that drink quite by taking control of your own life.
What you seem to be suggesting is that in a way that we're not fully aware of, we are constantly in dialogue with that higher consciousness, that spiritual consciousness, just the extent to which it penetrates in our minute by minute kind of monkey brain consciousness is dependent on how much we're willing to allow it to, and physically what we've been doing down on this plane. Am I kind of getting that right? Is that that's the distinction you want to make, is that we're always in communication with that higher consciousness?
Yes, definitely. We are always. And the thing about the higher consciousness, it's a spiritual mind, because this is what I saw, because in those Who Am I prophecies, there was diagrams of how the human mind was working. You know, and I'm not a scientist, Alex, so I wouldn't know this stuff. So, but, you know, I've showed it to doctors and things like that, and they're like, oh, wow, this is blowing my mind. But we are constantly in a communication with that. And the thing about the spiritual mind, the spirit, it governs all your emotions. So you can learn to control your emotions to be so balanced that you have an actual peaceful, beautiful life by understanding that you are in control. You are 100% in control of what you, you know, you are doing, the decisions you make. And things like, you know, if you're in an unhappy relationship, you have to have courage. You have to end that relationship and not be afraid to be on your own, because being on your own is better than being in a subjective relationship. If you see where I'm coming from, it actually affects every aspect of life.
You know, Beverly, just in the last episode of Skeptico, I interviewed a woman who is a psychic and a medium, and quite surprisingly to her, all this was more or less thrust upon her. You know, she was an engineer in the United States, just kind of bopping along, and all of a sudden, boom, she starts hearing these voices from the spirit world. Wasn't in an after-death or near-death experience. She just starts experiencing this. And this has been reported by a lot of people. So she went and tried to figure out what's going on. She first went through the medical route and said, hey, am I crazy? This and that. And came to understand that she was encountering spirits in this extended realm. Some people don't accept that. Other people do. What does your understanding tell you about, one, whether you should do that, whether that is dangerous and not in line with your understanding of what Jesus is telling us to do? Is there evil in those realms? I mean, these are the questions that people want. This has been kind of put out there quite a bit that, you know, these realms are dangerous and you shouldn't delve into them.
I would have to say, from my experiences, that I wouldn't I wouldn't encourage people doing things like Ouija boards and things like that.
What about talking to a medium after someone has passed?
Well, from what I understand that's going on there, Alex, can I explain what I understand? See, she's communicating, the medium's communicating through her spiritual mind. And how I understand it, how it works, is say for instance me, right? My father's passed over. Well, there is a link between me and my father on this higher consciousness, because we had this love when he was alive. So there's this link there that goes on. Now, as I see, when you open your higher consciousness, you can, because the spirit actually communicates through thought, it's not spoken words. And mediums are actually able, their consciousness, the higher consciousness is opened, and they're able to communicate through thought. And the way I understand it is they are actually communicating with your higher consciousness, and you're the one who's communicating with your father who's passed away. So you're giving her the information that's being fed that way. I don't see it that they can actually link themselves to my father, because there's no energy between them. There's no link. You know, I may be proven wrong on that case, but it's just how I understand it. You know, why would someone who doesn't know me, doesn't know my dad, be able to tell me that my dad's passed over and he's happy and things like that?
If we get past the mechanics of it, though, what about, is it evil? Is it, you know, a lot of people say that, especially in the Christian community, there's people who say that, you know, all spirit communication that isn't ordained or mediated by Jesus is somehow, you know, evil. And what do we do with that?
The thing about it, through his teachings, he's actually teaching us to cultivate our higher consciousness so that we will evolve. So eventually we will be able to communicate with each other through the higher consciousness. And that's in part the Who Am I teachings, with the diagrams of the mind. Now, there is an evil spirit or dark spirit, whatever you want to call it. I've seen it, and it's not pleasant.
What is it? What is it? What's your best understanding of what it is? What is that evil?
Negative force. It's like, what seems to happen is, it's someone who was evil in life, okay? It's someone who did despicable things. And when they've passed over, they've literally not wanted to change, and they've literally absorbed all the bad things that they did, and they've not wanted to look any further to change. And so they've remained in this sort of like cocoon of darkness. And, you know, I do think that you have to be careful. You have to be careful.
What is the relationship between that darkness, that evil, and this Jesus light love thing that you're talking about?
It's petrified of him, absolutely petrified of him. I mean, I learned after, you know, many, many years, and I'm talking many years.
But why be petrified? I mean, the thing I've heard over and over again is this spiritual teaching that, and I'll just throw this out, you know, because that's the only way we understand this stuff is if we kind of toss it around and stuff like that. But what I've heard is that the first part, I've heard that many, many times, is that this evil thing that we do is really a confusion part. It's a loss part. It's a as above, so below, as below, so above. You know, you can see all the evil in this world. You don't think that that extends. What are you thinking? It all changes, immediately transforms. No, it doesn't. It extends. And then I've also heard, as you suggested, that it has a tendency to maybe kind of coagulate, if you will. So the evil seeks evil and is drawn to evil for the same bad reasons that it might be in this realm. But what I've also heard is that the light is what it's really all about. Everything's going to the light, and that any evil being at any time can look up and look to the light and go to the light and be transformed through the light. And now I'm starting to sound really spiritual in a way that I don't have any direct experience with, but I'm just recounting what I've heard. So is that consistent with what you've heard? Because that kind of paints a different picture of the evil, that it's all under God's, you know, all under God's light umbrella. They're just kind of hiding over there in the corner, and as for as long as they want to do that, that's their business, but it's they all have to go to the light eventually. What do you think about that kind of idea?
Yeah, I totally agree. They have to go to the light eventually. But there's no sort of like, not everyone wants to be a nice person. There's just a few amongst us, well, quite a few amongst us, where we live our lives with hate and we kill people, we avenge people, and we don't have a consciousness. And it's all about the conscious side of it, the spiritual brain. If you don't teach yourself the values between good and bad, then when you pass over, you don't seem to be, able to understand those questions that you're being asked about, your truth. You seem to be retaliating from them all the time. But to me, eventually, they will come forward. I mean, you know, I saw one or two ADEs where I actually was pointing to the light and I was directing a spiritual entity to go to the light and seek forgiveness, to go to the light and learn. And that was an interesting one as well. So you were
directed to try and help this spirit that was not able to go to the light? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like a lost spirit. And you know, and it seems like, you know, even going back to that consciousness aspect, if you teach yourself to swear all the time, if you're someone who swears all the time, when you're in that spiritual existence, the swear word is muted. So if you want a proper conversation with someone, you know, don't teach yourself to swear, because I met one particular gentleman, and he's tried to communicate with me, and every other word was dubbed out. You know, it was like... I know, and I couldn't understand him, and I didn't get frustrated with him, I just lost interest in him, so I walked away, you know, if I believe me of your company, you're not interested. And he became quite frustrated because that was happening to him all the time, all the time. Now, somewhere in his learning process, he's going to learn you were wrong to teach yourself to swear all the time. You know, your spirit is light, your spirit is beauty, it's love.
Some people are light and love while they're swearing. So I don't know if I, you know, those are some of the things like, so a lot of this stuff I can totally relate to because I've heard it so many times that it has some substance and weight, you know, because I've heard it from so many different sources. But then other stuff does seem to contradict with, you know, I mean, the historical Jesus is a mess as we've explored on this show. So I don't know. anything about the historical Jesus, but I know it's a mess. I know from the beginning the Bible has been corrupted and used by people who want to manipulate it. So I'm very skeptical of Scripture, because every line of that Scripture you can take and tear it apart and find all sorts of contradictions and all the rest of this. I'm skeptical of the stuff like, you know, Jesus doesn't want me to swear. Jesus doesn't care if I swear or not. Jesus cares what's in my heart, right? Jesus sees through my language. I can say any frickin' thing that I want. People don't like me to say fucking, so I don't say fucking on the air. But I can say whatever I want. Jesus is able to look through and see my heart. And I'm just substituting their people for Jesus for the purposes of this conversation. The other thing he says, Jesus wants us to follow us. Wants us to be afraid and bow down to him and all the rest of that. Again, that doesn't jive with what I've heard. What I've heard is it's like a light bulb up there. And that light bulb is always there. And you can look to that light and go there, or you cannot look to that light. But all these little Mickey Mouse rules about, you know, you can't swear, you got to follow, you got to do this, all that stuff that we learned in church seems to be, while useful to some people, is extremely limiting and extremely counter to the spirit of the teaching, if you will, as opposed to the letter of the teaching. So
I think where you're coming from there, I know what you said, Jesus doesn't care whether I swear or not. It's not about that, what he's teaching in these things. He's saying, you know, why do you want to teach your spirit to swear? Because that's what he was explaining about this teacher in us all. So when you swear, when you use that kind of language, you're teaching yourself to do that. And you are almost, you are light, you are energy, you are, you know, amazing. You are part of this universe. So why do you want to limit yourself with, you know, silly language and stuff like that? And it's that kind of approach rather than the, oh, you must do it this way or you must do it that way. Because at the end of the day, you know, you can turn away from him and you can just carry on going down this path.
It does seem to me from investigating this stuff is that everyone has a unique experience with this higher consciousness. And that's kind of the fundamental thing that you're trying to bring forward, is that we're constantly in communication with this higher consciousness, whether we're aware of it or not. I wonder and worry that we become too literal in interpreting our unique experience with that as somehow being universally true. And I've just seen that over and over again with people who have that experience, and then they have that experience, and then they saw whoever, they saw Jesus, or they saw Buddha, or they saw some great being from the past, and they then extrapolate that out and say that that is somehow real, unique, and not only real, unique to them, which I can accept, but somehow universal and a message that everyone needs to get. I'm just less sure about that, because if I just step back and say, well, gee, Beverly, there's a dozens of people that I can point you to right now who have had similar kind of out-of-body experiences or channeled experiences or near-death experiences with some sort of quote-unquote divine intelligence. And what they've told us coming back is in some sense consistent with what you're saying, but in other ways, not at all consistent with what you're saying. So that's the challenge I think I face in trying to understand this. And I guess the main question I have is, do you feel me there? Are you sensitive to what I'm saying? Because there's a lot of different stuff out there. Do you think you have the answer?
I think that my case is unique. And I think it certainly offers a controversial slant on near-death experiences. And I think that's quite important, because I think we don't explore near-death experiences to the best of our ability, because from what I have learned, it's not just a nice experience as, you know, here's love and everything else. It's important. It's important that we learn about the consciousness. It's important that we learn we have the higher consciousness. It's important to try and access the higher consciousness. so that we can bring some healing to this world. You know, not just, oh, I had this experience and this happened and I changed my life. How about let's try to group these together and let's looking at them and saying, well, what is the reason that we are being given this insight? You know, there has to be a bigger reason. And that has to be surely towards the world rather than just to an individual's life, society. You know, because we are messing it up pretty bad at the moment, Alex.
Beverly, do you think we are at a unique and special time in history?
Yeah, I do. I think we're about to enter into like a spiritual awareness, a spiritual awakening. And I think if you bring those people together, and to a point, I even put it out there, and I've got no proof about this, by the way, but I do put it out there, that scientists might find more information about the reason that certain people have an NDE and come back and certain people don't. It might be in our DNA. I mean, could you imagine? The reason I actually say that is because, without trying to sound, you know, thingy, but if we found something in our DNA as to why some people's brain cells might last longer and recover quicker, could you imagine that that could actually change how we're looking at cell deterioration illnesses? So there's more about NDEs than meets the eye. They're not just a nice spiritual experience. They are, to me, world-changing. They're life-changing. And that's what we need to start looking at. And I think scientists should do their part as well, not just psychologists, but scientists as well.
I don't disagree with you. And I don't get the sense I don't get the sense that NDE researchers are saying that it's just this little experience. I get the sense that they just don't know how inside of the medical scientific establishment to kind of take it that next level. And that's why I kept pointing to Dr. Jeff Long, because I think he's been brave enough to say, well, wait, it does say more about these bigger picture questions we're talking about in science. But I get you. That isn't covered enough. Let me go back to the earlier question, because, you know, what do you say to the fact that throughout our recorded history, which is relatively short in this sense, but at least, you know, pretty solidly 100 years, 150 years, there's been these constant, this is a unique time, these prophecies, whether they're apocalyptic prophecies or spiritual transformation prophecies, over and over again. I mean, we keep hearing this over and over again, and it, you know, it never seems to come to pass.
Well, I'm not talking about an actual singular event, Alex. I'm talking about an educated event that's going to start. We are going to learn more about the human consciousness. We are going to learn as people through free will.
But why would it be so? Why would it be so? You know, temporal in this kind of time frame. I mean, we're talking about. First of all, do you believe in reincarnation?
I've never experienced it, I'm afraid. So I can't really give an opinion. I do know that many, many people have had experiences where they actually have felt that they were here before.
But in all your out-of-body experiences and experiences with the divine and experiences with Jesus, the idea of reincarnation never came up?
Not with me. That doesn't mean say it doesn't exist. You know, I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It's just one thing that is just something that never came to the surface.
Because one of the things that the reincarnation research, science, if you will, and there has been some pretty decent science on it, suggests is that we kind of got this time frame thing really kind of mixed up. And we're talking about just time as being endless and a soul journey being very, very long. And that kind of calls into question this, you know, immediacy. Something's happening right now. It's like, well, you know, it's a bigger time. Maybe it's a bigger time scale than that. What do you think about that idea?
Well, no, I think it's more. I think what we're going to start doing, because we can only take it so far. I'm not talking about the spiritual side here. I'm talking about the physical side. We can only take it so far before we will literally start destroying each other. We're almost there in that respect. And I think that we are going to step back and say, enough's enough. How can we move forward? And I think it's going to be this awakening from the physical aspect, if that's what you're wanting to ask me about. It's the fact that I think the science field will start exploring it more. They'll start bringing about, because the consciousness not only exists after death, it changes. So why does the consciousness change? How does it change? And that's easily established when you see these people who come back and they change their lives because they've become with more knowledge through the ADE, the NDE. So to me, I feel like it's going to come from us because we're going to want to change. We're going to reach that point, you know. It's just something that's going to happen. It's evolution to me. That's the word I'm looking for, actually, Alex.
Great.
We're going to step into an evolution.
You know, Beverly, you've been great. We've been going on for quite a time here, and I appreciate it. What else should we tell people about either your experience, your teaching, the book? Of course, they're going to want to check out A Journey of Actual Death Experiences. Tell folks how they can connect with you and if there's anything else we really – and anything else we might want to kind of talk about.
Well, you know, they can find the book on the internet. I'm on Twitter. And, you know, just type in my name, Beverly Gilmore, and try and trawl through all the Monster Inc. and Co. writings that have been written about me. You know, I can assure you I'm not a monster or an alien. I've had that thrown at me as well, believe it or not.
What do you think of the alien UFO thing?
I'm curious. I am curious. I've never seen anything or experienced everything, but, you know, I mean, this is a big universe, so... Alex, you know, so
right.
I'm curious. I have to be.
Right.
There's an email address here if you want to. You know Oliver's email address?
Sure.
If you spell that out, anyone who's had an ADE or NDE can contact me. And also, from what I've been through, I counsel people who are going through grief situations, you know, who are terminally ill or survivors of people who are terminally ill. So if they want to get in touch with me, by all means do, because one of the things I want to say is it's about, you know, putting yourself out there and just saying, you know, let's spread this, let's remember that at the end of the day we are all about love, we are all about positivity, and we are all capable of amazing things if we come together and help each other and do these things. So, you know, by all means, anyone who wants to get in touch with me, I'm more than happy to answer them.
Awesome. Well, it's a great message. It's a wonderful message. And I appreciate you coming on and being on the show. And Oliver, thanks again for persisting with this and making it happen. So.
He's a stubborn one, isn't he? But I really want to thank you for answering me in, what was it, 209, was it? 2010? You know, you see there, you actually reached out to me and you actually said, you know, yo, Bev, you know. And that quieted me. That made me feel, you know, less of, because one of the things, I used to feel like I was a freak of nature. And the odd correspondence I've had from people who have been kind, I want to thank them from the bottom of my heart. Jeffrey Long was one of them, by the way. So, you know, you have my deepest and my greatest respect forever. So I appreciate that.
Oh, that's very nice of you to say. Well, it's been great having you on, and I hope that we can spread this message through this interview. So thanks again, Beverly.
You take care. Look after those children.
Will do. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks again to Beverly for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess the big question that I'd have to tee up from this interview is, do you think Beverly encountered Jesus? And what does that mean to even say that someone encountered Jesus during an out-of-body, near-death experience? I know it's a question we've looked at before, but it does seem to be quite central to this whole mission of trying to chart out these extended consciousness realms into the few tattered puzzle pieces we have. So I think it's worth visiting again and again. So I'd love to hear what you think about that. Of course, a place to do it is through the Skeptico website by leaving me a comment or sending me an email there, or through the Skeptico forum, where we'll, I hope, have an interesting dialogue about this as well. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up, and I, of course, hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.